This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and I've been very much looking forward to this podcast. It's very apropos because as we move into the warmer months, it's Lyme season. The ticks are out in force, and they also happen to be a vector for many co-infections. And so I wanted to cover this subject, but I wanted to cover it in a novel way. Because today's guest offers a unique perspective on Lyme disease. He's written a great book. It's just out, The Lyme Solution. He's a naturopathic physician, Darren Ingles. I've known Darren for a long time. He's a respected leader in natural medicine with numerous publications. He's done international lectures, 25 years experience in the healthcare field. He received his doctorate in naturopathic medicine from the prestigious Bastyr University in Seattle, Washington. And he has also published extensively. He's the author of The Natural Pharmacist, Lowering Cholesterol, Natural Treatments for High Cholesterol. He's a medical journalist, so that's reflected in his book, which is really wonderfully written. He also works with childhood developmental disorders. He's written a chapter in a text for autistic children. And his latest focus, and it's appropriate because he practices in Connecticut, sometimes here in New York, but he's based in Connecticut, is Lyme disease, a five-part immune-boosting plan to fight inflammation and beat Lyme disease permanently. And that covers an integrative natural approach to the treatment and management of Lyme disease. So welcome, Darren, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Great. Thanks, Ron. I appreciate you having me.
Well, I'm going to start out with this because this is in the news, and I'm sure you're aware of this series of recent studies. Headline, prolonged antibiotic use has no benefit for persistent symptoms of Lyme disease. And it relates to a study called the PLEASE study, which was published last year in the New England Journal of Medicine. And they say it's the first randomized study in Europe to examine the effects of long-term antibiotics on chronic Lyme symptoms. So, I mean, the theory is, you know, for those of you not familiar with the Lyme scene, is that, you know, you can get treated initially with antibiotics for Lyme, and, you know, maybe you'll score a hit, and no problem, you'll be fine. But many patients go on to have inexplicable, debilitating symptoms. And the theory is maybe they still have Lyme, so they're given powerful antibiotics, sometimes intravenously, sometimes multiple antibiotics, sometimes over a period of years. And so a lot of this is speculative, and many studies suggest that at best you get temporary relief from the antibiotics, but long term, it's not a cure. And that actually is a central thesis of your book, because, Darren, in your book you argue that antibiotics may be part of the problem. You say the irony of conventional Lyme treatment is that the very protocols doctors offer routinely exacerbate Lyme disease and undermine your chance of recovery. What did you mean by that?
Well, I should qualify this that, you know, I'm a Lyme patient myself. So I was infected in 2002 and went through the normal treatment protocol, you know, 21 days of doxycycline. And I had classic Lyme disease, all the typical symptoms. And after 4 days, I felt great. But 8 months later, I started having symptoms again. And when I went back on antibiotics, it did nothing. And I did what a lot of other Lyme patients do and tried different antibiotic regimens. And none of them, helped. And in fact, I felt worse and worse and worse. So it was really kind of
helped that you were a health professional because you had access to, you know, the very best Lyme specialists, many of them your colleagues, and, you know, that didn't really do the job.
Absolutely. And again, all these very well respected doctors in the field, and they certainly did their best. But I just know it wasn't helping me get better. In fact, I said my gut was feeling worse. I was having more gastrointestinal problems, which is a typical, you know, side effect with antibiotics. And I think what a lot of people who end up with would have now really been referred to as post-Lyme syndrome. They don't really call it, you know, chronic Lyme disease, although they're pretty interchangeable. But this post-Lyme syndrome is really the effect of what Lyme has done to the body beyond the initial infection. And what some of the literature shows is that it actually has the capacity to induce really like an autoimmune kind of syndrome. So when the focus is really just on treating the organism, we haven't done anything to shift the way the immune system is responding to what the organism has done to the body. And I think, you know, we know that 80% of our immune function comes from the gut. When we start having changes in our microbiome as a result of the antibiotics, we start to sacrifice, you know, the normal health of both the gut and the immune system. So my book is really focused on, you know, what else can we do to help, you know, improve immune function without destroying our normal gut ecology in the process.
I think the appropriate analogy might be where if there's a forest fire and we suspect arsonists, maybe the police can apprehend the arsonist, put him away, but the fire still rages. That's not the solution. It may reduce the chances that the arsonist is going to pour more gasoline on the fire, but the fire still rages. I still have to put it out.
Right. And as you mentioned, you know, in the beginning of the podcast, is that, you know, we now have several studies that are showing that, you know, using antibiotics in this post-Lyme syndrome really have been mostly ineffective. And in clinical practice, I mean, I do have patients who do go on antibiotics and they feel better. However, the overwhelming majority, when they come off the antibiotics, have pretty significant regression and their symptoms come back or they feel worse. And then they kind of start that cycle again of, you know, a new antibiotic regimen. And I think one of the interesting trends that we're seeing in the Lyme world is, you know, we keep moving up to more powerful antibiotics. So, you know, it's not even just 21 days of doxycycline now. Now we're talking into doing combination antibiotics, which could include 2, 3, 4 different antibiotics. And, you know, we're even pulling out some of these old antibiotics we use to treat, you know, tuberculosis and leprosy, all of which, you know, tend to have a lot of side effects and have to be very closely monitored for toxicity. So I think it really begs the question, you know, are we doing more harm than good?
Indeed. Many patients, however, are simply not aware that their rather vague symptoms are due to Lyme disease because, you know, it's often chalked up to aging or stress, or maybe the patient is depressed or suffers from psychosomatic symptoms. You know, coming up with a big list of problems is sometimes a sign that maybe the patient's got a little hypochondria. But when should one suspect chronic Lyme disease?
Well, you know, we call Lyme the great mimic, and this is some of the difficulty that we as practitioners have in diagnosing Lyme. And I guess I should say before going further into that, you know, that Lyme disease is a clinical diagnosis. And what that means is it's really based on your compilation of symptoms. You know, even if you go to the CDC's website and read about Lyme disease, they tell you it's a clinical diagnosis. You know, we don't have a lab test that proves 100% you have Lyme disease. What the current lab testing tells us about whether you've had exposure. And even in that, the test that's available is not a terribly good test. You know, I was a microbiologist before I was a doctor. I used to do this test for a living, and we used to kind of joke in the lab that this is really not a very good test. And in the, you know, 40 years of, you know, researching Lyme disease, we really haven't changed the criteria by which that test is evaluated. So it's really kind of old information that hasn't changed. And as a result of that, you know, many, many people with Lyme slip through the cracks. In addition, you know, Lyme can mimic, you know, there's 180 symptoms that are associated with Lyme disease. So it looks like, you know, chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia and chemical sensitivity and multiple sclerosis. And, you know, the list is quite lengthy. So my advice is, when you've got these symptoms that are really persistent, you've been to your doctor, they've done the routine test, and they're just coming up, you know, repeatedly negative, you know, that may be a time, particularly if you live in an area that's known to have Lyme disease, to start digging a little bit deeper and see if that's part of what's going on for you.
Is there another danger, especially in this era of a proliferation of so-called Lyme-literate physicians, that if you go to a doctor who specializes in Lyme, you know, virtually any symptom will be construed as being due to Lyme disease, regardless of test results, and you may undertake unnecessary treatment and miss a true diagnosis?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a saying that if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yeah, so sociologist Bruno Bettelheim said that once, and it's a great saying.
And it's true. I think in the Lyme world, it's very easy to look at every symptom with Lyme glasses. So I think it's very prudent that, you know, whoever you're working with, that, you know, Lyme is part of that workup. But you also have to exclude other possibilities. And there are other autoimmune conditions such as lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, MS, that aren't necessarily Lyme driven. And it's very important to rule those out as well. In saying that, there are many, many people I've seen who have gone to several doctors, had, you know, thousands of dollars of various tests done that keep coming up negative. And we run Lyme tests and we see that they have exposure, and then we start treating and we see them get symptomatically better. So you always have to take it with a little bit of grain of salt. And if you're working with a Lyme literate doctor, I know a lot of these guys, they're all very well intended and they really want to help you get to the source of your problems. But there is a tendency sometimes to only look at just the Lyme part and potentially forget about some of these other things that might be causing your symptoms. So, you know, you really want someone who's taking a very sort of 30,000 foot view of your health and make sure that they're really covering all the bases.
On the other hand, many doctors lack Lyme disease awareness. And I think I saw a statistic once that cited the fact that virtually two-thirds of Lyme disease diagnoses come at the prompting of patients. You know, the patients come to the doctor and the doctor says, well, I don't know what's going on with you. And the patient says, hey, doc, maybe don't you think we should test for Lyme disease? And the doctor goes, yeah, sure, fine. They tick the box and boom, you know, turns out the patient knows best.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. And I certainly have had plenty of patients in my practice that have come in asking to have Lyme. You know, I think certainly in the Northeast United States, where Lyme disease is so prevalent, you know, everybody knows somebody who has or has had Lyme. And so often at the suggestion of, you know, friends and family, they're told, hey, you know, go find someone who's going to test you for Lyme disease. So it's not uncommon that they come into the office and they're asking for that test. But in many cases, they do have a legitimate, you know, symptom picture that would suggest that. You know, at least in my office, again, we try to cover all the bases and look at all the other possibilities that can be triggering their symptoms. But certainly looking for Lyme disease and co-infections is part of that. Is that part of that workup?
Indeed. And so you talk in your book about an immune boosting plan. But I think probably what you really mean is it's not necessarily boosting, but regulating, because part of the problem is that we've got an out of control, maybe hyperactive immune system that we want to modulate, because it's kind of on a rampage and we want to turn down the volume on certain things and up parts of the immune system or accentuate parts of the immune system that help to resist infection, correct?
Absolutely. And, you know, without making everybody an immunologist, I think it's important that listeners understand this difference between what we call TH1 and TH2 cells. And TH stands for T helper cells, and they're really the conductors of the immune system. And TH1 cells are the cells that are really responsible for actively fighting infection. They're one of the direct scavengers of the immune system. But TH2 cells are the cells that are more involved in antibody production. So these are the ones that get upregulated with allergy and autoimmune autoimmunity. And I think what we see in a lot of Lyme folk and other autoimmune diseases is that there's this very high Th2 dominance. And so that's not the appropriate immune response that we expect when you get an initial infection. This is the inappropriate response where your immune system just keeps, you know, cranking out all these antibodies that ultimately start affecting our other tissues. And it can be your brain, your joints, your muscles, your gut, and so forth. So ultimately, you're right. We're really trying to modulate the immune system and get a better balance between these Th1 and Th2 cells.
Is Lyme chronic because the bugs are hard to kill? Or is it chronic because typically there are no longer any bugs because they've been treated early on, and there's sort of an echo of an immune system response that mimics an autoimmune disease? Or is it a bit of both?
You know, it's probably a bit of both. You know, I think we don't have conclusive evidence about when you treat Lyme disease, do you ever completely eradicate it? My opinion is I don't think we do. Mm-hmm. And the reason is I've seen plenty of patients over the years that have recurrences over and over. And is it they got bit again, which, of course, is possible. But it's also possible that it's really just a reactivation mm-hmm. of the same illness that's been there. And we see this with other types of bug-induced autoimmunity like strep. You know, you get strep and you can get rheumatic heart disease, rheumatic fever, and there are possibilities of having recurrences because strep is really part of your normal flora. Yeah. You know, we have evidence that Lyme's been around for 5,000 years. You know, they dug this guy in Austria. They called him Otzi the Iceman.
Yeah, right.
And when they tested his blood, they found he had, you know, DNA of Borrelia, which is the bacteria that causes Lyme, in his blood. So this really isn't a new organism, even though we've really come to understand it in the last, you know, 40 years or so. It's been around for a long time. I think something has happened, though, in that 40 years that our immune system is treating it more almost like an allergen than a pathogen. So this ability for microbes to induce this autoimmune process, which is very complex, and I don't know that we fully understand it, but I think it's that capacity of the organism to trigger that inflammatory response where people end up with, you know, this post-Lyme syndrome.
You know, Darren, we have listeners all over the country and all over the world, and perhaps for some listeners, they're dismissive of this. They say, well, look, I live in a state where there are no Lyme ticks. I live in Arizona, or I live in California, or I live in somewhere in the Pacific Northwest. And this disease is typically, I mean, it's named after Lyme, Connecticut, so the epicenter is Connecticut. Maybe it extends to New England, certainly Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York. Hard to apply it to other states. True or false?
Yeah, so I think when we see these folks that live in sort of non-epidemic states, I'll give you a great example. I have several patients that live in Australia. Australian government says there's no Lyme disease in the entire country. And yet when people get tested, even by conventional CDC standards, they test positive. So I think we've got a few issues that we haven't quite resolved. I think one is ticks may not necessarily be the only vector for Lyme disease. In fact, there's some evidence coming out of Europe that mosquitoes and fleas and other biting insects have the capacity to transmit Lyme. So it may not be solely tick-borne. In addition, we also know that there's about 100 different strains of Borrelia. We test for one. So we may not even be testing for the right strain depending on where you are in the country. And we know, in fact, about half of the cases of Lyme disease in California are not Borrelia burgdorferi. That was the first organism we identified in Lyme, Connecticut. And that still comprises the majority of cases we see in the Northeast and the Midwest. But in the West Coast, there's an organism called Borrelia miyamotoi that accounts for about half the cases of Lyme disease out in, you know, California and Oregon and Washington. So we're not even testing for necessarily the right organism. And typically when you've got several strains of bacteria, there can be cross-reactivity in the immune system. But I think that may explain why often we'll get some of these Lyme tests back. And I'll say they look gray. You know, they're not completely negative and they're not completely positive. And it may be that it's just a different strain of Borrelia, not Borrelia burgdorferi. So we don't get this full immune response. We get a partial response because of that cross-reactivity. But you know, as a result, the test comes back negative. So we have some big obstacles to overcome in Lyme testing because now there are so many different strains and there's no one test that looks at all of them. You know, every time I go to a Lyme conference, I hear about more and more things that ticks can spread. And, you know, whether it's the different strains of Lyme or the co-infections, boy, it just seems like that list gets longer every year.
Indeed. So it, as part of your program for restoration in patients who are on that, in the Lyme quagmire, as you refer to it, when treatments fail, when they're stuck, when they have multiple symptoms, it's not clear whether they're all attributable to chronic infection or the aftermath of the devastation of the therapies themselves. You start in a chapter entitled The Role of the Gut. What's going on there?
Well, you know, I think this is naturopathic medicine 101 is, you know, we start with good gut health. You know, when you have a healthy functioning gut, we know that your immune system has its best chance to work the way it was designed to. So this is where we really start looking at diet. We're looking closely at the kind of foods you're eating. And we're also looking about your elimination patterns and getting all that information about, you know, how well is your gut really functioning.
And when it comes to diet, you have very specific suggestions about avoidance of certain foods that you think might be potential allergens. And you favor a kind of a plant-based alkalinizing diet with modest amounts of protein. But you feel that that is something that helps to restore immune balance.
Yeah, and, you know, having tried various diets with people over the years, you know, the autoimmune diet, the paleo diet, I mean, all of these are similar in so many ways that it really reduces or eliminates, you know, simple carbohydrates and junk food. Mm-hmm. Again, mostly plant-based diet with, you know, limited protein. But I started, you know, reading a lot about foods that really promote better alkalinity. And we just know from cellular physiology that our cells function best when they're in an alkaline state. And with the exception of, you know, the stomach, the bladder, and for women in the vaginal area that's very acidic, you know, the rest of our body actually is very alkaline. And, you know, there's a lot of old information out there. And in fact, our forefathers very much looked at, you know, the pH of foods and how it affected body pH. And it's kind of interesting because when you look into the medical literature, you'll actually find very little research looking at this. I mean, I found really two studies, both that showed very positive effects on, you know, eating this way. But I just started playing around with some of my Lyme patients. And of course, I ate this way myself. And I just find that this seems to induce the best gut health, immune health in people who have chronic Lyme.
You speak to the role of leaky gut syndrome. How is that related to Lyme symptoms?
Well, the nature of leaky gut is, you know, it's like poking little holes in your intestinal tract. And as a result of that, you know, very large molecules that would normally be filtered out are able to pass through. And when that happens, it promotes inflammation. So inflammation in the gut can then start to affect your digestion, your absorption of nutrients. So even if you're eating a very good, healthy, organic diet, it's possible you're not really absorbing all of those good nutrients because that inflammation becomes a barrier. So ultimately, our plan is then to try and repair the gut so that we fill in those holes, bring those cells closer together so that that barrier that's supposed to be there becomes more intact.
Okay. And there's a role certainly for pre and probiotics in this?
Absolutely. You know, the prebiotics are things like fructooligosaccharides and inulin and fiber. And these are all the things that our normal healthy bacteria need to reproduce and to thrive. And then, of course, the probiotic part is actually replacing those beneficial bacteria that would normally thrive in the gut. So for anyone who's ever been on antibiotics, and again, most of the Lyme patients I work with at some point have been on at least one course of antibiotics, you know, we know that even one dose of antibiotic has the capacity to wipe out your gut flora for several months. So for people who've been on antibiotics for, you know, 21 days, a month, or even longer, you know, it can take a long time to really rebuild that gut ecology. So by replacing those beneficial bacteria, we start getting the gut back to its normal healthy function.
Right. Well, good. We've laid the groundwork for a discussion of integrative treatment of Lyme disease. And I think this book is really an important contribution because too often we rely on what pioneering microbiologist Robert Ehrlich once termed the magic bullet. You know, these laser-like therapies designed to kill pathogens. And that paradigm is kind of failing us in Lyme disease. It's leaving some patients high and dry in terms of recovery prospects, and your book really fills in the gaps. So in part two of today's discussion, we're going to talk specifics. Your book lays out some very, very sophisticated protocols for patients with Lyme disease. So we'll drill down and provide a deep dive on some of those in just a moment. Today's guest, Dr. Darren Ingles. He's a naturopathic physician based in Connecticut and author of a great new book, The Lyme Solution. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.